Hey folks, have you heard of cancer-fighting foods? The American Cancer Society discovered diets rich in fruits and vegetables may actually lower your risk of cancer. Think about that for a second. That's really important. Hopefully you hear this and run to the store for 5 servings of fruits and vegetables every day. But if you're like me, you probably don't have the time to do that, right? So maybe you should consider adding Field of Greens to your daily health regimen. Each fruit and veggie in Field of Greens was doctor selected for studied health benefits. There's a heart health group, lungs, kidneys, and metabolism groups, even healthy weight. What your body needs is in each scoop of delicious Field of Greens. I take it every day. Sometimes I put it in a shake. Sometimes I put it in my egg white omelet in the morning. Field of Greens can help prevent, treat, and cure cancer? No, but it can powerfully help you out at your next checkup. Your doctor will notice your improved health or you're going to get your money back. Here's the most amazing thing about it. I started using Field of Greens a year ago. My cholesterol is down. My blood sugar is down. My weight's down. My health is up. My sleeping patterns are better. My metabolism is up. If you want to experience what I've experienced, go check out Field of Greens. Jump into the ring here. You're going to get an enormous benefit. And it's so simple. Single scoop, a couple of seconds, healthy lifestyle all day long. Now, thanks to our good friends at Brickhouse Nutrition, Field of Greens is going to give you a 15% off discount plus free rush shipping. All you got to do is go to fieldofgreens.com and use the promo code JUSTNEWS for your discount. That's promo code JUSTNEWS at fieldofgreens.com. Fieldofgreens.com, promo code JUSTNEWS. Go check it out. Hello, America, and happy Monday. What a show we have planned for you. We're not fooling around. We're going to start this week with a bang. The FBI whistleblower who has blown the whistle on the January 6th investigation on the padding of statistics to make America's extremism problem look far worse than it is, who claims that the rights of defendants and suspects are being violated, and that the FBI is being weaponized so that even if you didn't commit a crime, going through the process of an investigation becomes your punishment. That FBI whistleblower, he's joining us today on the show. He is Agent Steve Friend from Florida, and he is one of 20 significant whistleblowers that have gone to Congress to blow the whistle on what they say is the politicization, the misuse, the abuse of the FBI's law enforcement policies. We're going to have him for most of the show. That is an incredible moment. And I want you to listen to some of the words he uses in the interview. I got the chance to talk to him over the weekend. There is an extraordinary thoughtfulness to what he's talking about. And listen, he's not being partisan. He says he's worried about the future of the Bureau and its trust that it has with the American people. And he says most of his colleagues share his concerns of not as many are willing to come forward as he has been for fear of losing their job. So Agent Steve Friend, we're going to have for most of the show. And then, hey, when you're on a roll, you're on a roll. Ambassador Rick Grenell, former Director of National Intelligence for the United States, he's in the house. We're going to have him for the second half of the show. A really interesting point he's been making about the failures and incongruity of the Biden administration's foreign policy. Think of this. This is what he tweeted out over the week and caught my attention. The Biden administration wants to give billions to Iran. Iran is giving kamikaze drones to Russia to kill Ukrainians who were funding in the war. So it's circular. We're helping Iran. Iran helps Russia. Russia attacks Ukraine. We're supposed to be helping Ukraine. There's something wrong with that picture. Ambassador Rick Grenell is going to give us the real insights later in the show. So stay tuned. We've got an amazing show. Agent Steve Friend, the whistleblower, followed by Ambassador Rick Grenell right after these commercial messages.
Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Mm. Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient, comfortable.
Tell us a little bit about your career. I mean, you started in law enforcement, you moved to the FBI, and my understanding, you had stellar ratings up until this summer, right?
Yeah, that's correct. I began law enforcement as a police officer in Savannah, Georgia, back in 2009. Joined the FBI in 2014, my first assignment out of the FBI Academy. I was sent to the Omaha field office. Omaha has their area of responsibility is all of the state of Nebraska, all the state of Iowa. So they actually stationed me in Sioux City, Iowa, which is northwest Iowa, right near the border with South Dakota and Nebraska. Spent about 7 years there investigating violent crimes, major offenses that occurred on Indian reservations in the area. There were three tribes there. So spent 7 years working there, had stellar reviews, exemplary performance. At that time, I was relocating. You know, I was the senior agent there. There was actually even from the higher ups some mild pressure to reconsider relocating and to stay on there and almost be a quasi supervisor capacity. Right. But after being there for 7 years, it was time to get a little bit closer to home for us. So there's an exit benefit for the agents who work a certain length of time on Indian reservations because it's so hard to fill. There's only about 150 agents who work in the entire FBI.
Wow.
So yeah, it's not for everybody. It's very independent, high case volume. You're considered fully assigned at 25 cases, but I consistently 30 to 40 cases was pretty consistent for me at any given time. And you know, I think I probably opened over 200 cases in 7 years. I got over 150 arrests. So it's pretty busy day to day. And it's just, a burden on the agents and their families. So they give you a nice little incentive to try to get people to raise their hand to do it. I happen to just get sent out of the academy to do it. But having done it, I really enjoyed it and would have probably volunteered if they'd asked me at the time. So, relocated. We went to the Jacksonville field office, and they had some vacancies in some of the resident agencies. So we chose Daytona Beach and moved down here June of 2021. At the time, the supervisor who was minding the desk there set it up to be a transfer for me to work child exploitation, child pornography investigations, human trafficking investigations. So came in, and that's sort of a cousin within the FBI to Indian country investigations. And the real reason for that is you have to liaison with locals in order to gin up casework. And there's just a tremendous volume of them. And you're just turning a wrench on one to the next. And so took that on, worked that until their fiscal year rolled over. So beginning in October, so it was about 2.5 months. And at that point, the supervisor that had been in place when I arrived in Daytona had actually a few weeks before had retired. So until his permanent replacement came in, there was a void there. Leadership in Jacksonville called down and said that I was going to be reassigned to work domestic terrorism cases as a member of the Joint Terrorism Task Force that's in Daytona Beach. I was a little bit upset, because I'd taken the transfer with the understanding I was going to be working these child exploitation cases. But I'm a team guy. But my real concern was that I'd made a lot of promises to a lot of the liaison partners here that I had 8 years in the Bureau, so I was not looking to relocate or promote. I was going to be here for the next decade and a half and just wanted to work with them and not kind of felt like 10 weeks in that I was going to be backing out on a lot of promises. The response that I got from leadership was that those investigations were going to be considered a local matter going forward and that domestic terrorism was the highest priority that we had.
Wow. So basically, yeah. Let the local police and all the child exploitation, sex trafficking thing, and the FBI is backing out of that business.
Yes, yes. I mean, if there was something that was, you know, huge, like a Nassar type of investigation, you know, especially after what happened with Nassar, I think they would jump on that. But you know, it's the crimes are abhorrent, but for the most part, even the federal prosecutors are kind of like, well, there's so much of it out there that they can't really make their bones on those cases. They're looking for bigger, higher profile cases, and they think that the states can and the county prosecutors can really bring charges. I disagree. I mean, I think you if you work something simultaneously with locals, a lot of times you can choose your own adventure on, you know, federally or state, what would be the more advantageous route to go. But yeah, they pulled us back and said, let the locals handle it.
And do you think this was a local mandate, meaning coming out of Jacksonville and Daytona Beach, or do you think this was a national mandate in terms of abandoning of the child exploitation cases?
I suspect it was Jacksonville. I can't really speak to the other field offices. I do think though in Jacksonville that it was a definite effort because I was a one man operation doing child exploitation cases, but there was an entire squad in Jacksonville working them. And I would lean on them for just advice and cause I had no experience and they got completely broken down and they left two agents to look into those cases and everybody else was moved over to a violent crime squad. So they definitely were pulling us back from those type of cases.
Amazing. Wow. So that happens. And then you start getting assigned to some of the January 6th cases. How many cases did you get assigned in the domestic terrorism realm when you made the move?
So January 6th cases are not necessarily all domestic terrorism cases. It's kind of weird. They are being investigated by the JTTF. So they, you know, you have the resources and assets there from national security, but a lot of them are actually riot investigations, which is a criminal charge. But, at the time that I got moved over, they may be a case agent on, I believe two that were, domestic terrorism, extremist, you know, entity cases. And I saw a couple others that were, riot cases. But I gotta be honest, I can't pin down an exact number because there was nothing to do on them. So I never really kind of kept myself still sequestered from them because until the new boss arrived, and even after he arrived, he kind of gave me the nod that there just wasn't any work to do on that side of the house and just make myself available should anything come to light, if any work needed to be done. But
so
they were,
you were essentially on paper, the case agent, but the cases are really being worked out of WFO. Is that right?
Yeah, yeah. So when I got moved over, I saw these cases. I'm a criminal background. So my immediate, action is like, all right, what do we got to do? What needs to be done on them? And what I got back from the guys in my office was, well, we've done everything that they asked us to do from Washington. We're just waiting on them to tell us what to do. If they're going to charge it, or if we need to do more work on it, or if they're going to close it out, we're waiting on direction from them.
Wow. And what's the danger when you're listed as a case agent, but really all the investigative work is being done by a different office and agency?
So we're working at that point outside the rules of the DIOG, the Domestic Investigation Operations Guide,
right,
that's set up for the FBI to carry out all its cases. So a crime or an entity, a criminal enterprise exists, and an investigation is opened. That is, whoever owns that case is the case agent on that case. Their office is the office of origin for that case. They have carte blanche, for lack of a better term, on how to properly pursue the investigation on the case. Now, headquarters in our guide can use their judgment as to determine what is the office of origin. But once they make that call, it is in the hands of that case agent and that office to really make decisions. Now, if you need work done outside of your area, like if I needed a subpoena served in Dallas for a case, like it wouldn't make sense for me to jump on a plane and serve a subpoena. I would do what's called
a cuddle field office.
Yep, they would do it. So, if a case of January 6th was opened in Washington, which to me makes sense just because the crime occurred there, then they could cut leads to us to do anything, to interview the subject, to go get evidence, even arrest the subject. But it's their case. If they decide that the case needs to be opened here, then it's our decision on how to proceed. So it creates problems there. Just what, you know, who's running the show. And it also, to me, created some Brady material issues that were going to pop up if a defense attorney was on point at trial later on.
And describe that, because basically you're the, were there any instances where you were asked to swear out an affidavit or something, but it really was what WFO's office work?
No, I actually didn't swear out affidavits, even to arrest the subjects in the cases that I was listed as one of the case managers on.
Yeah.
The agents in D.C. and the task force up there was swearing out the affidavits. My point, though, was, Brady material is essentially the government has to turn over its and all its material that's, you know, relevant to a prosecution. I just could foresee a pretty easily, you know, avoidable or a bad situation where, you know, Steve Friend is the case agent on John Smith, who's being prosecuted for January 6th. I'm put on the stand because it's my case, and defense attorney says, well, agent Friend, what did you do? You're the case agent. And I would say, I didn't do anything. Well, did you make this decision? Well, no, I didn't. Did your supervisor approve that? No, he didn't. And it just seemed like that was could be a massive problem. And then you could wind up actually, I could be cross-examined by the federal prosecutor where they would basically have to impeach my credibility, and I should be working with them.
Unbelievable. And why do you think they did this? Why take the risk of having a field agent in Daytona be listed as the case agent when in fact all the work's done in Washington? Did they tell you why they were structuring it this way, which was in contravention of the DIOC?
Yeah. So the first supervisor I had in Daytona, I asked that exact question, and he told me that he was on a conference call that was nationwide with supervisors from around all different field offices, and headquarters relayed the message, quote, it was to get buy-in from the field.
Wow.
That's not something that's an actual term. That's not an actual, investigative strategy.
Not in the DIOG. Yeah.
No. So at that point, I started to, surmise, even formulate my own opinions on what, I think the real reason is, and this is, outside. It's in my complaint.
Yes.
So, it's in public. Yeah. But I definitely think it is to further the narrative that domestic terrorism is a widespread issue around the country. They're essentially flattening the total number of cases that are stemming from one incident in one city on one day, and they're spreading them around the country to give the illusion that it is a nationwide problem when in fact it's a one-time incident. So the analogy that I always use to explain it is, if you do an analysis on police officers killed in the line of duty, you basically throw out 2001 because of 9/11. And the reason is that the bottom line number is so huge compared to other years. And it's not because there was a huge uptick nationwide. It was because the tower was coming down in New York City.
Right.
So similarly, they've not changed the bottom line number, the total number of cases, but they've made the illusion around the country. And there's actually a reasonable case that you could be made that the entire January 6th case should be one case, and there shouldn't be cases for each individual person. So that's even a disputable thing, where now you've made 900 to 1,000 cases out of one incident.
Yeah. So basically, it becomes a form of statistical manipulation to make it look like there are hundreds of cases around the country, really, when it stems from a singular event in Washington on January 6th.
Correct. And there's tremendous incentive at leadership levels for that to happen, even in the field offices. The senior executive staff, the special agent in charge of the field office, there's metrics for them to meet where they want to have a certain number of national security cases open. And this is, a way for them to get on it. And then the known fact is, if you have a national security case opened up in the FBI because it is, such a high priority, and this is not just stemming from January 6th, but just since 9/11 and generally, the amount of resources that are at your fingertips is incredible. It's, with no questions asked. I mean, if I needed a surveillance team for somebody tomorrow, I just cut a $30,000 check and the team's here. Whereas if I'm on an Indian reservation in Northeast Nebraska, it took
you're on your own
it took me 6 years to get a recorder to
wow.
interview, to record my interviews. So there's a huge disparity in, you know, incentive and resources available. And there's a very big pot of money available on national security.
Amazing. That's an amazing part of the story. I don't think I understood until today. That's really great. I know you've had some concerns about the way some of the J6 defendants that you were asked to pursue have been treated. And I've been told by some of your colleagues of some episode where you were asked to target a guy at his son's funeral. Is that accurate?
So I received a Guardian lead that came out. There was not an actual case open on the individual. It was an anonymous right. tip. That they said that they had, it was from Rhode Island, that they had looked at the FBI site identifying, you know, an unknown person. They said, I think it's this person. So without anything else, they had done a check of facial recognition software, nothing. They checked the guy's cell phone. There was nothing. They said, go out and interview him. So with an anonymous tip, that's, you know, I don't think a knock and talk interview is warranted, but that's, you know, that you can dispute, you know, and you can, reasonable minds could say, well, yeah, it's warranted. Let's go
so
for an interview.
I just want to make sure I understand this. Beyond the anonymous tip, there was not a shred of evidence that this guy had engaged in anything criminal. Is that correct?
Correct. Absolutely
wow.
correct. So that was actually the first thing I ever did for anything pertaining to January 6th was going to this gentleman's condo, knocking on his door and saying, I'm with the FBI. Were you, you know, at the Capitol on January 6th? And he
right.
said, no, that was the day of my son's funeral. So I wasn't there.
Oh,
and
I
gave my business card and I said, thank you. And I left.
Wow. And no one ever asked you to go back a second time, right? That basically ended the case at that point.
At that point. Yeah. I mean, I documented it, sent it back. I don't, that individual, at least from my office, hasn't been approached again, as to my knowledge.
Right. Right. And then you spent how many years on the as a member of a SWAT team? When you were out in the Indian reservation, you were also trained for SWAT. Is that correct?
Yeah. So every field office has a SWAT team. I was on the Omaha field office SWAT team from May of 2016 to May of 2021, right before I transferred.
Wow. Yeah. And the general principle of SWAT is that it's really a resource of last resort, correct?
It's special weapons and tactics. So there's a matrix that exists from the FBI that provides guidance on when it should be used. And, you know, it's typically used for the, you know, perceived danger. You know, if there's somebody who's got a violent history, if there's, you know, potential for firearms to be available, they want to have that extra layer of training and tactics available to
sure.
secure the area or even arrest the subject. The other agents are perfectly capable of doing it, but you know they don't have the extra training that SWAT operators do. So it's just it's an extra tool in the toolkit for the field office. But it normally, you know, there's a fair amount of assessment that goes on as to whether or not we're going to use SWAT for a particular operation.
In the last year since you moved to Florida, have you ever seen a SWAT team deployed without meeting the terms of the matrix that you're normally supposed to meet?
No, but the terms of the matrix are pretty broad. They're supposed to be,
okay.
you know, taken in good faith, but the presence of firearms, especially in a state like Florida,
yep.
SWAT would be used to arrest me even if for a nonviolent offense because I have personal firearms.
Right.
So it could be justified.
The threshold for this, right? Yeah.
So it's a fairly easy matrix point to hit. And it really depends then on pushback from SWAT team leaders and SWAT team supervisors, but they, you know, they have a fun toy and they want to use it. They want to give their team an opportunity to go out and do well and then, you know, receive funding and then an accolade. And so there's definitely an incentive to use SWAT from them as well.
And before you moved to Florida and got signed January 6th, did you ever see a SWAT team deployed for a misdemeanor offense?
No, I was never on any SWAT deployments for misdemeanors. You know, at least at the time that we had a warrant in hand, you know, it was for me for a felony. Down the line,
right.
maybe somebody, you know, was pled to a misdemeanor. I can't say, but no,
right.
my entire SWAT experience was for violent felonies, for, you know, drugs. We, you know, I was part of the, one of the teams that was involved with the Governor Whitmer takedown that we were right. sent over to assist with that. So that was the type of cases that we were working on.
Right. And that would be a, you know, legitimate use. When did you realize that they were using SWAT teams for January 6th defendants that were nonviolent and misdemeanor in criminal nature?
Well, so there's been a little bit of confusion about this. I knew that the operation that I was objecting to participating in was going to involve SWAT. I believe yep. that the individual that they were going to charge was going to be charged with a felony. Okay. Now, my objection was not that SWAT was being used to go arrest somebody who was charged with a felony. My objection was right. this was an individual who we'd been in contact with, who we knew already had an attorney, who had been cooperative with us.
Right.
And that to me seemed like a little bit of overuse of SWAT. There's yep. a lot of other mechanisms that, you know, you could just straight go to the person's lawyer and say, you know, here's a summons to come to court. If you wanted to catch him, there's, you know, obviously no lack of resources. Surveillance could be conducted and we could,
right.
you know, intercept the person on their way to work or, you know,
yep.
even just liaise with locals like I did, you know, and that was the other thing. I arrested over 150 people, violent criminals on Indian reservations. They committed things ranging from rapes to aggravated assaults to homicides. I never used SWAT. I never myself even approached the residences. I always liaised with my local police, tribal police partners, because they knew the individuals and they could go up,
right.
knock on the door and say, "Hey, Mr. Smith, you got a federal warrant. You got to come with me, man." And there was never an issue. The person would just go
yep.
because they, you know, they were being treated with respect and they had already talked to me and, you know, they
take
knew
the lowest temperature approach, right?
Yeah, correct. So I pointed that out to leadership. I said, you know, look, you know, one of our considerations is there an unnecessary risk of danger? And I said, frankly, we've been fairly lucky that we haven't created a Ruby Ridge scenario where somebody, you know, is coming back from a hunting trip and, you know, then all of a sudden there's a tactical team at their door with a Bearcat. And,
yeah.
you know, that could be completely avoidable, especially if we have an open line of communication with this person. We spoke to them and they have counsel and we could bring it to easy resolution. You know, I don't know what a search, I could, you know, search is, a search warrant is definitely a legitimate tool.
Sure.
But it's also perfectly legitimate to call a person's attorney and say, "Hey, you know, we need to get the beanie cap that he was wearing that day. Can he turn it over?"
Yep.
And at that point, that it's incumbent on the attorney to say to his client, "Yeah, they, you know, the FBI needs that, you know, needs that beanie cap." So that
right.
we can be perfectly professional and civilized, and that's sort of the FBI's reputation.
All right, folks, we'll be back with more with our exclusive interview with Agent Steve Friend, the whistleblower, who decided to call out the FBI for its treatment of January 6th defendants right after this commercial break.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Why do you think the more militant approach to all these arrests, has anyone described to you in leadership or among your colleagues why they were using the shock and awe approach?
I was told that there were three legs to the stool when it came to making the decision. It had to be legal. It had to be within our policy, and it had to not put me or any of my coworkers in an unnecessary risk of personal safety. They said as long as they met all three of those components and they decided to use SWAT, that they were perfectly within their within their rights and within the rules to do so. And that is correct. There's, you know, SWAT is a legitimate tool. My pushback to them is I felt like there was an aspect to it that was the punishment was the process. You know, even if somebody, you know, eventually is either, you know, acquitted or say they even plead guilty to a misdemeanor and they wind up spending a month in, you know, incarceration, the very fact that a tactical team was coming up on their lawn with a bear cat and at 6 o'clock in the morning, potentially throwing flashbangs in their house,
right,
and terrorizing their family and alerting the neighborhood, like that just seemed to me like a little bit of an overkill. And for me to say that, with my background, I felt like, you know, was saying something, because I'm hardly the shrinking violet. I did SWAT myself. I think it's a,
right,
it's a great tool and a great resource. I've arrested so many people that, you know, I'm not somebody who's saying like, you did the crime, but you don't do the time.
Right.
I thought there was just a better way and a better approach to doing it. And I voiced that with my leadership. They just didn't share my opinion.
Yeah. At what point did you realize you felt like you needed to blow the whistle, that you need to go, even if it meant the end of your career at the FBI, that you would have to come forward? And what was the, when you summarize, you know, I had to come forward, what is the ultimate ailment or wrongdoing that you think the FBI needs to fix to keep agents like you in the field and not lose them?
When word came out that we were going to be doing these arrests after, you know, at this point, it was over 18 months since the incident. And, you know, there had been ample opportunity to consider, reconsider, and they had actually even pushed back and thought for a minute that they weren't going to charge some of these people, and then had reached new conclusions from Washington. That's when I said to myself, look, we're not running these cases ourselves, and that's outside the rule. And, you know, and we are setting ourselves up for, you know, a major fall. So I brought that to my supervisor's attention. I brought my concerns about not following FBI rule. I brought my, you know, concerns about potentially abusing power to him. And, the feedback I got from him, I actually even volunteered to do alternative duties, make myself available. At the time, there was a wiretap going on for a drug case. And that's pretty
right.
Mundane work. That's sitting around waiting on a phone to ring for, you know, 8, 10, 12 hours. He said that was not going to be acceptable for me. I was going to be having to participate. And then just various factors of, well, I'm technically a case agent on this case, and I'm not involved in the planning of it. And I'm being told that I'm going to have a, you know, responsibility to transport somebody for this case, you know, to the magistrate. That I'm being told what my role is going to be, and I'm one of the case managers. So it's pretty clear to me that we're not actually in charge of our own cases, which is a problem. So the he heard me out and said that he respected my opinion and respected my my integrity to come to him, but ultimately he passed it on up to the next level of management. They requested me to come in, express the exact same concerns. I had a long sit down meeting with them. In that course of that meeting, there were some statements that they made to me that were extremely disturbing. At one point, one of the assistant special agents in charge said, you know, he made accusations that I was being a bad teammate, and he questioned why I believe that people who killed police officers didn't need to be charged with a crime.
Right.
So my response to him was that no police officers were killed by anybody on January 6th. None of the protesters or rioters or whoever you want to call them had actually killed a police officer. And he was floored by that response. It was as if that was new information to him. So I said, look, ultimately, I don't want to be involved with anything with these cases. It's just these cases. I will do, I'm a team guy. I will do domestic terrorism investigations. I will do international terrorism investigations that need to be done. But I feel like I have a potential conflict of interest here. And, you know, if that exists, I think there should be a reasonable accommodation made. They disagreed. So after I left, I said, can you just, you know, let me know how this process is going to play out? And they said it was going to be a long time. I was going to, you know, the federal government is like a turn in an aircraft carrier. So it would be a while before anything came out. Within 3 hours, I had an email from them saying that I was not to report to work the next day, and that I was going to be considered absent without leave, and my pay was docked for one day. I returned the next day after that, so missed one day of work, then had another meeting with the next level up of supervision, and that was the special agent in charge. Again, expressed the same concerns, and at that point, she said some things to me about, you know, I held a little fringe belief about January 6th investigations, and that I was, you know, under some sort of misconception, and that, you know, there was some sort of conspiracy going on within the FBI, I should probably do some soul searching about whether or not I felt that I could continue to work for the agency. She said that I couldn't possibly understand, because she had been on the seventh floor of the Hoover building that day, that the people tried to seize our democracy.
Uh-huh.
And the fear that she felt was real, and that this was a legitimate investigation that was going on. And ultimately, I just said, look, we received training in the FBI. It is a significant part, a significant day where you go to the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum, and you go to the Martin Luther King Jr. Memorial. And the message of that day is that abuses of power can lead to things like genocide and gross civil rights violations. And that's only able to happen if the police in that government are an apparatchik of the state, and they refuse to stand up against it. And I said, frankly, I think I'm in keeping with my training, and I'm in keeping with my oath. I think we could be violating people's Eighth Amendment rights with cruel and unusual punishment. I think we could be violating the due process rights by, you know, not following the rules that we have set out for carrying our investigations. And she didn't agree. And then within a few weeks, my suspension came down. And I received notice that it was for my unwillingness to participate in January 6th, and then for an unrelated incident where at that point I knew I was in the disciplinary process. I sought some legal guidance and counsel, and they asked me to get an employee handbook for them to have as a resource. So I got that document, and they told me, the FBI said that I improperly accessed that document, and that was security that was a security matter. So my security clearance was suspended.
Wow. For accessing the employee manual that you're supposed to be able to refer to, right?
Correct. Yeah. I accessed the employee manual, some guidance on disciplinary procedures, the DIOG, and then also got every quarter, the Office of Professional Responsibility gives us an email where they say potential violations and discipline, and then what are the, what are the ramifications? So I figured that would be a good rule of thumb to know what I was going to be getting. So I got the last 5 years of those emails, so I would have them as a good rubric to what to expect would be a reasonable punishment should I be disciplined.
Right. Well, and for that, your security clearance is pulled, right?
Yes. Yes, it is. It's suspended. Security division is going to be doing an investigation.
Yep. When you go through this process and you see the answers and you see a supervisor who's unaware that actually officers weren't killed, they may have died from stress or something afterwards, but they weren't killed by any perpetrator on January 5th. You hear the supervisor talk about how she saw democracy being destroyed and threatened on January 6th. Do you have any sense, do you have any concerns that these are political beliefs, or that there are partisan political beliefs driving some of the decision making in the inside the FBI?
I think no matter what, you know, we're all human and we all bring different biases to the table. I think when you know, if you're inclined to believe one thing, and you combine that with the incentive that you could become involved in what's considered one of the biggest investigations ever in the history of the Department of Justice and the FBI, and you could promote your career out of it. And it's also something that you might, you know, think is a righteous cause. There's an inclination to go to that next level, which you're willing to step outside the bounds of the rules and perhaps even, you know, work against your oath that you took.
Wow. And I've learned this having covered many whistleblower cases inside the FBI, going all the way back to the early 90s.
Oftentimes, when there's one who comes forward, there are many silent who share the same concerns. Have you encountered other colleagues in the course of your work who have similar concerns about exceeding the manual, taking risks that aren't necessary, or mistreating or excessively treating defendants in this investigation?
All my interactions are almost universally like that. So, you know, I might be one of the two whistleblowers that were willing to sit down in the room with the bosses and express it.
Right.
But whenever I've spoken to my colleagues, and granted, I don't know everybody in the FBI, but I do know a fair amount of them, and as well as the retired agent population, to a man, everyone has said that they disagree with how this has gone on, which is one of the reasons that I kind of was shaking my head when my special agent in charge said that I held a fringe belief about this. And I said,
right.
I said, well, you maybe need to, thinking to myself, you might need to take the temperature of the room a little bit more from your
right.
people, because, you know, talk to the members of the JTTF that I worked with. They were all essentially sitting in limbo with their fingers crossed that Washington, D.C. was going to decide not to charge these people with crimes that they felt were not real crimes. They were, you know, had walked into the building or even just been on the ground. There was there's a whole line now where they're going to extend the area outside of the Capitol, you know, the four walls of the Capitol, the perimeter, and say that that lawn is a restricted area. And they're just going to come down with another wave of charges for misdemeanors for, you know, entering a restricted area. Or, you know, maybe somebody has a pocket knife and they happen to be standing on the lawn outside the Capitol.
Right.
Well, it's possession of a weapon on a restricted area. Now you're really in trouble, especially in Washington, D.C.
So have you witnessed them trying to expand the perimeter in recent months to get more people charged?
I heard conversation from other members of RJTF that in their discussions with Washington, which, you know, full disclosure, I was not really a part
right.
of these talks.
Right.
You know, I was trying to do my child exploitation cases and, you know, be available to do January 6th when, if there was legitimate work to do. But yeah, they said that they were hearing, hey, they're going to start to expand the zone to get more subjects because they're really trying to send a message.
Amazing. And that's really at the end of the day what you see, right? The process is to send a message rather than to use the FBI guidelines to conduct every investigation the same way, right? This one is being, in your mind, handled differently than the way most other investigations under similar circumstances would be handled.
There's no question. The process is the punishment. You know, I sat in with an interview with somebody. I don't know if they're going to be charged with a crime, but the very fact that I was sitting there and they were, you know, dealing with the stress of talking to two FBI agents in a law office for an attorney who I'm sure was not free. You know, if that gentleman doesn't get charged with a crime, he's still out, you know, having to pay his attorney, and he expressed to us he was going to be out of a job because his employer was upset with him being involved at all. So that's somebody whose life was completely turned upside down, and that doesn't even begin to know if he's going to be sitting in an orange jumpsuit at some point.
Yeah, amazing. And then let me ask this last thing, because an odd thing happened right around the time that your suspension came down. Your wife has a Facebook account. Apparently, it gets suspended or taken offline as a result of some messages she sent through private messenger, right? Not public posting. Am I understanding that correctly?
Yes, that's correct. My wife has a Facebook account. It was hacked months and months ago, and she had to go through some hoops to get it back. She was just worried about her, you know, friends of hers that were getting some weird and solicitous messages, and she just wanted to actually get her pictures back. So she went through the rigmarole to get her account back. She showed and verified her identity with a driver's license. Once the account got restored, she changed the name on it. My wife's from Ukraine. So her,
right.
She uses the Cyrillic alphabet for her name, so it didn't display her American name. We had a friend reach out to us one Sunday right after my name became public, and he said that, hey, there's somebody from Moms for Liberty Group who has a message for you, and the message was, hey, you know, we'd like to help Steve any way we can. So my wife reached out, sent a private message to this woman saying, I'm Steve Friend's wife. It would be great, you know, any support you can give us just to share the story, because at that point I had not come forward and discussed anything.
Right.
My wife does not post anything publicly. She only sends private messages. Within 30 minutes of her sending that message, she got a notification from Facebook that her account had been suspended for violating the community standards. And then she appealed, and then the next day her account was completely taken offline.
Wow. And can you find any community standard that's been violated?
No. And from listening to Mr. Zuckerman's discussion of private messages, it was my understanding that those they did not have any access to looking at those. And I just found it very, very unusual, because the only thing that would indicate, you know, who my wife is, was her saying, "I am Steve Friend's wife" in the message.
Now, granted,
she provided her ID. But, you know, I was joking that I said, well, I think my entire story might be a little bit difficult to censor, because my last name is Friend, and Facebook is probably going to have a really hard time getting an algorithm to put
you ain't
to express
kidding.
It.
That's a pretty common
but I
word.
I guess they found one.
That's funny. Oh my gosh. Last thing I want to ask you, because I know how momentous a decision this has been. When you boil it down and you tell the American public, I did this because, and for other agents who might feel the way you do, what advice might you have for them at this moment?
So I told my wife when I came to this original decision, I said, this decision is not easy, but it is simple. And my message to anybody else is just that. We raised our hand and we took an oath before our family and our friends and the Lord Almighty, and we are supposed to be people of integrity, and that's not a leisure pursuit. And if you are indeed a person of fidelity, bravery, integrity, the FBI motto, then you have to be willing to do things that aren't easy, especially when they're as simple as stepping up and pointing out when we are not meeting the standards that we have set out for ourselves. And I honestly am a person who wanted to serve the country. This was my dream job. I actually believe in the mission of the FBI when it's being carried out properly and within the law and within our rules. And I think that a lot of good can be done. And I guess it's sort of an old fashioned value, but I think that's a little bit sad. I have interacted with so many people along the way who are great agents and great individuals. And I just hope that they will, you know, not just look at, you know, I've only got a few years to retire from my great pension, or, you know, I got to put food on the table for my family. I understand all that. I'm in that position myself. I'm not getting paid for my pension, but I can put my head down on the pillow at night and sleep comfortably knowing that I did the right thing. I know one day, you know, my children, they're young now, but, you know, and then it was always a nice little ego stroke when they said to me, you know, my dad works for the FBI. I know that when my time on this earth is over, that that they'll look back and say, hey, my dad was willing to stand up and, you know, fight bullies. And that's why I became an FBI agent. And when the FBI became a bully, he was still willing to step up and stand against it. And that's what I take solace in.
Well, it's an amazing story to hear you speak and the thought that you brought into this. And I really appreciate it, Steve.
This is a thrill. This is a thrill. I'm a big fan. I love your work. You know, I've got your books.
Thank you, sir.
So, you know, thank you for the opportunity, and I'm honored to have had a conversation with you.
Yeah, it's an enormous, enormous privilege on my side as well.
All right, folks, when we come back, we're going to have a good conversation with Ambassador Rick Grinnell, former Director of National Intelligence. Before we do, though, I want to shout out one of our extraordinary advertisers. We're so blessed to have partners and sponsors and advertisers in the Just the News John Solomon Reports family. And one of them is Medline. I love Medline. When I would go up to my cabin up in the Shenandoahs, I would wake up every morning in excruciating pain. My right shoulder would be numb. It would be achy right underneath the shoulder blade. And you know, when I got home, I didn't have the problem, but for some reason, there's something about the mattress or the bed that I have out in the cabin, and I have been frustrated for a long time. I had a neck problem. I solved that years ago with Mike Lindell's My Pillows, but this shoulder thing at the cabin, it was frustrating me. Then MedClimb came along, and you know what? They create a therapeutic sleep system that solved my problem. That's right. They made a custom solution for my right arm and shoulder so that my shoulder would loosen up and I would sleep right, not impinge the nerves. And son of a gun, if I don't wake up every time at the cabin now, raring to go, no longer in pain, no longer needing to take ibuprofen and Tylenol, actually just ready to roll. Well, that's what MedCline, M-E-D-C-L-I-N-E, MedCline can do for you. One of the great things about it is that they have developed it, a patented pillow system to cushion your body in a sleeping position that is supremely comfortable. Doctors have recommended it, and also it's been clinically proven to provide effective natural relief for things like reflux, which, by the way, is affected by the way you sleep. Shoulder pain, that was my problem. So if you want to solve those problems, the studies that they've done, the clinical work they've done, shows that 95% of patients reported an overall improvement in sleep quality when using MedClimb. That's impressive. 95% of anything's impressive, especially when you think about the pain you could be in now that you could alleviate. So our good friends at MedClimb, well, they have set up a special offer for you. In addition, they want you to know that you can use your medical FSA or HSA accounts to purchase MedClimb using your savings fund, and they're going to give you 20% off when you go to MedClimb.com/JustNews. MedClimb, MedClimb.com/JustNews, 20% off and a better night's sleep. What a good combo. How can you turn that down? If you're got acid reflux or GERD or shoulder pain or neck pain, have the folks at MedClimb find a custom solution for you. That's what they do. And you're going to get 20% off because you're a fan of Just the News and John Solomon Reports. How are you going to do that? MedClimb.com/JustNews. MedClimb.com/JustNews. Go check it out today. All right, we'll be back with our interview with Rick Grenell, former ambassador to Germany, former director of national intelligence, right after these messages.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey. Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
All right, folks, welcome back from the commercial break. So excited to have this next guest on. He revolutionized America's relationship with NATO. Then he went to the National Intelligence Office, and he actually got truth out that had been hidden there for so long. He is none other than Ambassador Rick Grenell. Mr. Ambassador, good to have you back on the show.
John, thank you. It's always a pleasure to be here.
It's an honor to have you on, and I love the crystal clarity that you often bring to debates. Washington usually has all this muckety-muck, and most Americans can't understand what's going on. You have this amazing tweet out this morning, and it catches the irony of our relationship with Iran, Russia, and Ukraine. You note that we want to give billions of dollars to Iran to get the nuclear deal done while they're giving drones to Russia to fight Ukraine, who, by the way, we've given $19 billion to help them fight the war. The inconsistency and incongruity of that picture, it must really frustrate you.
It frustrates me because I live outside of Washington, but for Washington, D.C. types, this is typical, right? They fund all sorts of foreign countries, foreign wars, foreign entanglements, and they don't ever really see the strategic blunder that is happening. And I think most Americans struggle with understanding the very clear reason why we're putting $19 billion into Ukraine. And look, I'm somebody who's been around foreign policy for a while, and I understand the importance of blunting Russia. I understand the need to make sure that we're standing up for our values. But I think that things get blurred in Washington when they dumb it down so much that everything is black and white. I was ambassador to Germany. I know Eastern Europe well. I know Europe well. And the reality is that Ukraine is not the purest democracy that people are making it out to be. It's a complicated situation. There's a lot of corruption. We say that a lot in Ukraine, but it is the truth. And Ukraine has traditionally been the bridge country between Russia and the West. And that means a little bit of Russia, a little bit of the West. They've been moving, inching towards the West over the last decade. And certainly Zelensky has moved them more briskly in that direction. And so we want to be able to think about these issues. But the hypocrisy right now, where this White House, Jake Sullivan, is negotiating with Iran, promising them all sorts of gifts to control their nuclear issue, which I would argue is not controlling their nuclear issue, but is encouraging them to continue their terrorist ways, while at the same time funding Ukraine. And now we see that Iran has sent their drones to Ukraine. So we, the United States, the Biden administration, is literally on both sides of the war now in Ukraine. We're working with the Iranians who are supplying the Russians, and we're giving money to the Ukrainians. It's outrageous, but for Washington, it just means that all those big contractors get to get more money. A war goes on, and they keep funding this whole mess. Meanwhile, diplomacy is pushed off to the side.
Yeah, it's such a missed opportunity. And you know, I hear from so many world leaders in the last couple of months the concern that Biden has not defined the purpose and the end game for the, supporting Ukraine. How big a problem is that when our own allies have ambiguity about what we're doing and what the end game is?
Look, you know, for me, the end game is always diplomacy. It's always a peaceful solution. I'm a diplomat. And this is my frustration with the Biden team, is that we don't see any tough diplomats out front. You know, remember, the fact is that Donald Trump and the Trump administration, we in the Trump administration, had sanctions on the Russian Nord Stream 2 pipeline. Everybody heard about the Nord Stream 2 pipeline from Donald Trump for 4 years. We thought that the Russian pipeline into Europe was a bad idea, so we sanctioned it. The Senate Democrats, United States Senate Democrats, the Biden administration, and Chancellor Merkel all got together and dropped those sanctions. Senate Democrats voted to drop the Russian sanctions on that pipeline. And that's outrageous, because quickly we saw, within just a few months, the war in Ukraine. I don't think it's too much, John, to say that the first waving of the white flag to Russia were the Senate Democrats dropping the sanctions. I mean, if you go back and you read what they said, they completely miscalculated the situation. They said that they were dropping the sanctions because it was bad for Russia to have these sanctions. Well, we obviously know it was really good for our policy to put sanctions on this pipeline, because it was averting a war, and now they ushered in a war. And my frustration is just, there's too much war talk within this Biden administration. Where are the diplomats? Where are the tough diplomats? Anthony Blinken has a plane. He has his own plane. He can get on a plane and go and start talking about diplomacy and peaceful solutions. Remember when Joe Biden messaged to the world for weeks that the intelligence showed that Russia was on the march to start a war? What was the solution from the Biden administration? It wasn't immediately try to do diplomacy. It wasn't rush to have Blinken go into Russia or to Ukraine to try to bring European diplomats or the UN and try for diplomacy. There was no try. It was Joe Biden announcing, I'd like to offer Mr. Zelensky a plane ride out of Ukraine to get out of the way of Russia. That was our policy. We wanted a war. The Biden administration wanted a war, not me. And I think it's outrageous that they don't get enough pressure from the media to show that they caused this war by dropping the sanctions on the Trump the Trump sanctions on the Russian pipeline.
Yeah, it's amazing. Meanwhile, we put sanctions by closing down our pipeline here in America, which created our energy crisis. It's just, it makes you literally scratch your head wondering what's going on. There was an amazing poll over the weekend at Fox News that really caught my attention. And it is that the vast majority of Americans, particularly Republicans, independents, overwhelmingly reject socialism, but more than half of Democrats think it's a good thing. How did the party of FDR and John Kennedy end up thinking that socialism is a good thing?
Well, look, you know, I talk to a lot of world leaders, and especially in Eastern Europe and the Balkans, and I've had one say to me, I don't know why you Americans are so surprised that your education system is in shambles and you have this problem with wokeism, because for 20 years, you've allowed your schools to teach your kids to hate America and to think America is the problem. And I think that's true. If you talk to young people, I was never more saddened than to see videos on 9/11 of young people talking about, you know, their observations and beliefs about 9/11. It was atrocious. We've got a lot of work to do. We have failed to fight in many ways. Weak kneed Republicans gave up our school systems to this woke culture. You know, and I get it. As a parent, you're frustrated that schools are so terrible. So you pull your kids out and you put them into a private school that's better, or a Christian school, or some sort of you know, private institution. And yet what we're doing is we're leaving these public schools to become terrible. And so we can't be surprised that all of a sudden these young people now are not only hating America and capitalism, but they're embracing socialism. It's got to be something that Republicans stand up and fight against and stop just ignoring.
Yeah, and there's some effort. We have a good story today about Florida and DeSantis and the legislature at least starting to dig into the higher education propaganda machine, but it needs a nationwide movement to root out all of this anti-Americanism that has creeped in.
And it won't happen overnight, John. People need to get ready for this fight. The same fight that I do in California through my organization, Fix California. I keep telling our donors here, you know, we didn't get here overnight. It's going to take us years to climb out, but we're making a huge difference in California, and our donors now are doing a 5-6 year commitment to say, we're going to turn this around. This is the greatest state and we've got to fight for it.
Yeah, it is. You've got to be prepared to move an entire battleship. It is going to take time. And, you know, one of the things that's impressive, liberals and Democrats, people like George Soros, they're very patient. They have long strategic plans and they're willing to wait to carry it out. And a lot of times Republicans are anxious, right? They want to move on to the next thing. But this is one of those issues where sticking to it and being strategic and fighting for the long haul is going to have a benefit for America, right?
Yeah, and I would say with this, that people listening to us right now, is that some people have to write bigger checks and some people have to get more vocal, but some people listening need to run for political office. They need to run for school board. They need to run for city council. These are the fights that are super important. And so I hope that people are considering local office. There's nothing more powerful than local office. I will just say this. I live in Manhattan Beach, California, and we've got quite an aggressive campaign going locally on city council and school board positions. And I just endorsed two people for city council today because everybody was asking me. And it's that important that here, you know, I'm literally concerned about the city council races in Manhattan Beach, California, where I live.
Wow. That's the sort of focus and granularity that conservatives need to have if they want to take back the country. And that's going to be a fun race to watch actually out there. It'll be a bellwether for whether California can be turned someday. Rick, I want to ask you about this. You did more than anyone to start the process of getting the Russia collusion documents out to the American public. John Durham's trial has been a narrative of building on those documents and giving us another round of disclosures where you find out that there were agents inside the FBI and the CIA saying, hey, this is Russian disinformation. Where are you guys going with this? The idea that an entire apparatus, the FBI, the Justice Department, ignored thousands of stop signs, thousands of warning signs. What do you think ultimately drove the FBI? I know the IG said, no politics involved, but it seems implausible that a very smart group of people at the FBI could have done this all by accident.
Look, it's this slippery slope that over time, what they do is they overclassify information. So whenever information makes them look bad, if they made a mistake, they just simply classify the part of it that they can get away with that somehow takes away the missing piece, right? So if you have one piece of the puzzle gone, then there's enough speculation of like, we're not sure what this is about or who this is about. And a lot of times it's just a name, right? You cover up a name and then you can really foil the whole transparency issue. And that's what I found to be the most frustrating. You know, I think I've shared this story with you before, but it's worth repeating, is that when I looked at the transcripts, the 50 plus transcripts of people who were testifying about Russia collusion, and they were testifying under oath with their lawyer sitting next to them, it was quite shocking how many times they said, nope, we never saw Russian collusion. You had Susan Rice, you had Samantha Power, all these people saying, I never saw anything. No, I never saw anything. But those same people were pushing the opposite message on CNN and MSNBC and in public. And so that's what got to me, is just the outrage of these people getting away with lying. And so I pushed for the declassification and the total unredaction of the information. And the first, you know, go around, of course, DOJ and FBI came at me hard and, you know, said that I'm releasing classified information, I'm going to be sued and threatening all that. But when I talked to the mid-level people whose names were on the redactions, they said, you know, I didn't do that. My boss did that. And yeah, I'm in charge of that file, so my name is on that, but I didn't approve that. And so when I would, you know, take the redaction away and I'd say, look at me in the eye and tell me that this is a source or a method, they couldn't do it. And they said, well, I agree with you. And I said, okay, well, this is a Washington way. We're going to get rid of this and we're going to post it without redaction. And, you know, the leadership then goes into convulsions and tries to threaten you. But it takes somebody to just say, I've seen it. You're lying. You're covering up for your own, you know, PR issues, for your mistakes at the agency. And if you just stick to your guns, you know what happens, John? They don't sue you. They don't come after you later. They're embarrassed.
Yeah, because truth is an absolute defense. That's what it is.
Yeah, they're embarrassed because, you know, I released those transcripts. They're still on the DNI website, dni.gov. Go to it. You can read the transcripts for yourself.
They were so important, such an important moment. I think really the turning point in a lot, in getting some of the mainstream media also to realize something's not right here. You know, there's something that smells right.
You still had those Politico and Washington Post reporters that were then, you know, attacking the messenger. They were like, that Grinnell, he's so terrible.
Yeah, he's terrible. He gave us transparency. How awful. It used to be that reporters were for transparency. I don't know when that fell out of favor.
Now they're openly attacking it if it doesn't fit the left narrative. It's really outrageous.
It really is. It's why America has so far abandoned mainstream media. They realize that they're getting a bad deal with it. I want to finish up with a very important moment. The polls show an extraordinary frustration in America with the direction on the economy, with the state of the world, with energy, with children, and all the issues that are occurring in schools. What is the key for conservatives to make this a wave election? Right now, a lot of the candidates are up by a couple points in the polls, but what's the key to get a mandate and say, hey, we're running the country, we're going to fix it over the next couple of years?
You know, it's such an interesting question. I do think the great thing about politics is that it's local, so it's slightly different in every state. And it's hard to know because you look at some of the polling. I certainly have seen some of the polling in the races that I'm working hard on. And, you know, sometimes it says that certain segments of the population are not responding to the crime issue, the rise in crime issue, because they're not impacted by it, right? So you've got a lot of our candidates saying crime is rising, crime is rising. And some people respond to that and some people don't. They're like, yeah, I see it, but it's not impacting me. And then the border issue, I think, is the same way. I think abortion is the same way. So this is a game where you have to figure out how to get 50+1% of the voting population. And so many times it's hobbling together a coalition of people that support you. I think there's no replacement for candidates that know their community. You really have to understand the different people in the community. And I'll just give you one example is I love Carrie Lake so much. You know, she's somebody who has really rejected the political class, the consultant class, and she just seeks advice from people that she trusts and likes. And she gets a little bit of advice here and there from, you know, she's not paying everybody. And it's one of the things I'm close to her, and I've certainly given her unsolicited free advice. What I love about her is she's always like, yeah, maybe, but I know Arizona and I don't need some consultant, you know, telling me what's important in Arizona. She's like, I know these people. I've worked with them for 27 years and I know them. There is no better candidate than somebody who lives, breathes, feels, and loves the people that they're trying to serve. And so, you know, you go back and obviously you have to have enough money, but you have to have a really good candidate that also knows the power of the media. And I think, you know, we've touched lightning with Carrie in Arizona because she is not the most well-funded. She didn't get enough money compared to her opponent in the primary even, but she won, and now she's being wildly outspent in the general there. But I think she wins.
Yeah, and now, you know, people are beginning to see, you know, sticking to your guns actually can be a good thing. You don't have to go with the winds.
Back down. Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's a reminder that the greatest politicians in American history are people who have stuck to their guns. Rick, real quickly, just before we go, you're doing a lot of work with candidates. You're doing a lot of work in California to start to change the dialogue there. What's the best way for people to stay in touch with all the great projects you've got going?
Oh, thanks. Well, I think two things. One, fixcalifornia.com is a great way if you care about flipping California. We have a five-year campaign, and John, I'm really proud of something. Over the last 18 months, we've built a force in California with money and a digital campaign, and we now are registering more than 11,000 conservatives a month in California.
That's amazing. I didn't know there were that many in California. How about that?
We're going to be growing even more and more over the next several months. We hit 9,000, then we hit 10,000. Now we're over 11,000 per month. We got a massive group of volunteers. We found all these conservatives in our first look. We found 1.4 million conservatives unregistered in California. We'll have to go back to another group and find another million unregistered, but we're working our way through it. It takes time, it takes money, and it takes really commitment from donors and volunteers, and we have it. You give us a couple of years, and we're going to make a huge difference. We'll make a big difference this fall. And then the other thing I would just say, as you referenced, is my Twitter account, at Richard Grinnell. I'm pretty active. I'm much nicer in person than I am on Twitter, I'll say that.
I'll agree with that as well. Yeah, absolutely. You have to stay. Your Twitter feed is must read. Your ability to crystallize things that often are complicated for everyday Americans is such a gift. I mean, just the example this morning with Iran, Russia, and Ukraine, you go, oh my God, why didn't I think of that? It's such an crystallizing moment when you see that. So such an honor to have you on, Mr. Ambassador. Can't wait to get you on again soon, but thanks for the time today.
Thanks, John. All the best.
You as well. All right, folks, we'll take a quick commercial break. We'll be right back after these messages.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe.
Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
All right, folks, welcome back from the commercial break. So excited that you can join us. Two very important guests today, Agent Steve Friend, Ambassador Rick Grinnell, both making some very important points about sanity, common sense in America. And when you think of that poll the other day that 3/4 of most Americans oppose socialism, except if you're a Democrat. There's a majority of Democrats who think socialism is a good thing. I think what Rick talked about, the education system churning out an entire generation of liberals preconditioned to like socialism, a very important part of the equation. All right, folks, we're so lucky to have you as our listeners. I can't thank you enough for all that you do to support Just the News. And we'll be back tomorrow with more headlines and exclusive interviews. I believe we have former Speaker Newt Gingrich in the House. Former House Speaker Newt Gingrich talking about elections, the state of America. That's going to be a fun conversation tomorrow. And also the candidate for Secretary of State in Arizona, where a lot of election integrity issues have been percolating for a couple of years now. Mark Fincham, he's also going to be with us tomorrow. What a great lineup. Until then, may God bless you. May God bless this extraordinary country of the United States. Thanks for listening to John Solomon Reports, a podcast from Just the News.